Welcome to the Love Out Loud podcast. And if you're new to our tribe, on behalf of the entire global family, just so you know, we love you. You're a part of a collective of millions now in over 40 countries around the world devoted to revolutionizing our views on love, global leadership, challenging systems of fear, and creating a new earth together. Love Out Loud takes you on a journey of learning how to love yourself and realizing your unlimited potential so that together we can create a unified and compassionate world. Our membership is the heart of our ever-growing global family, and we would love to see you in there. Join us for free now by clicking the link below. Sam, welcome to the Love Out Loud podcast. For the listeners today, we're doing a bit of an inception. So we're about to go live on Sam's Facebook, and we wanted to just bring you into the full journey transparently to talk about mental health. And because Sam's such an incredible advocate and she's organizing such an amazing and needed event, which Love Out Loud is supporting, I wanted this to be shared with the Love Out Loud community as well. So we're going to be putting this chat on the podcast, but Sam's going to be interviewing me on her Facebook. So just for some context, we're about to go live on Sam's Facebook, but Sam, do you want to say hi to the LOL community, all of our amazing listeners?
Hey, epic LOL community. So grateful to have you guys tuning in for this as well. It's the Enlighten Conference we're running, and so grateful to have Nicole showing up and all her energy, inspiration, expertise, and magic in support, and the Love Out Loud team. So grateful for that.
I'd love you to share with the listeners, because it was so in the spirit of what the Love Out Loud community support, you sharing with me what propelled you to move in this direction and out of kind of running events for other people and really following your heart into this work. And that's what this community is all about. So just whilst you're resetting up Zoom, do you want to share with them what that moment was for you, or what that journey was for you, what the vision of this ultimately looks like?
Wow. The one moment, you know, it's one of these things actually where I look at my life and I'm like, I think most of my life was actually pulling me here. I'm trying to find it, and I'm like, I think I was always meant to do this. But I suppose the one piece was, it was earlier this year. I was running an events company and events got shut down in the world, right? We were booked out for like at least 6 months solid with events, and they all got shut down. And I started looking at everyone pivoting and reacting and creating all these different things. And I looked at the stress and tension, the loss of meaning and identity and who am I on people. And I went, I'm meant to do something about that one. It's not about money anymore. It's not about helping people build their business. It's this spiritual, emotional, mental crisis, that wave that's coming. That's the one I'm here for. And the message came through so clear. It was like, everything has been preparing you to help with this. And I was like, okay, what do I do? And as a, you know, inspiration, it goes, well, you can sit and wait, you know, for guidance. You'll get told when you're ready. And it's good that it was a wait, because otherwise I would have built a reaction, not a solution. And so that's part of what, you know, was really on my mind, is like, what do people need? How do we get something accessible and, you know, inspiring and practical and holistic and really supportive of a new conversation about mental health as a culture, as a lived experience of wellness and recovery and all these things we talk about, but how do we have them be our everyday?
Yeah. You know?
And so that's the vision behind this Enlighten Conference. So Sam Higgins here tonight with Nicole Gibson. So excited to welcome you to the community and to have you tune in for this epic collaboration chat. I have tagged a couple of few key things about you, Nicole, in my video, but I'm also keen to know, in your words, like, what is it you do, and what is it about this mental health conversation that's so inspiring for you?
What do I do? I like to think about it as who I'm being. For me, that's a messenger of love, and the vision for myself personally is to just embody that more and more every day. And the reason the conversation around mental health is so important to me is that was my journey, my personal journey, and also my professional journey and background, which led me to this deep understanding of the power of love. That I worked in mental health, first leading a nonprofit, and really like having very, at the time, what were considered unconventional views on mental health. Like, lo and behold, everyone's having this conversation now, but 10 years ago when I proposed maybe, just maybe, the reason for this mental health epidemic isn't just a biological predisposition to experiencing mental illness. Maybe there's cultural reasons, maybe there's environmental reasons. That was considered quite a radical view. And the way that I was tackling that that challenge had really incredible results, and that led me to do political advocacy, and I went on to become a mental health commissioner and worked in many different spheres of mental health. And what kind of blew me away was the deeper I went and the more intersectionality I was exposed to nationally and internationally, I just realized we were all looking for the same thing. We all just wanted to be seen and heard, and we all just wanted love. And even the policymakers that I was working beside, for so many of them, they didn't have a safe space to be vulnerable. They definitely didn't have access to the depths of self-love I now know is so essential in making moral, ethical, reasonable, compassionate choices for all. And they didn't have access to that, and they were making choices that were impacting the lives of every single Australian and beyond. And I guess it was the sequencing, as you were sharing, of those moments that led me to recognize this really is what leadership is meant to look like for me, is stepping into that leadership role of being a messenger of love and compassion, and hopefully a leader that demonstrates that in what they do.
Yeah, for sure. That's very apparent in the way you show up, and the way Love Out Loud brings, you know, all its messages out. And I have a question: is inside those kind of spaces, right? Inside, because I've worked inside the mental health system in Northern Sydney, particularly more with actually training and advocacy inside the actual service, like less at policy, but. Inside those spaces, how is this conversation around love and compassion received?
In political spheres?
Yeah.
How is it received? I feel like when it comes to me and how I am, I kind of have a blissful oblivion, because I'm so in love with love that it sort of doesn't matter to me so much if people are in resistance to it, because I know that it's the truth. What I will say is I was definitely seen as rogue. I was definitely seen as an outlier, and a rebel. But after I left, after serving for 4 years on the commission, some really substantial shifts were made. When I stepped onto the commission, so just for some context, I became a Commonwealth Commissioner at just before my 20th birthday, and I was the youngest commissioner in history by over 30 years. So usually you get appointed, yeah, as a commissioner sort of in the later part of your career, and it's a role that's bipartisan, and you act as an advisor to the respective leader of whoever holds the portfolio that you're advising. So when I first became a commissioner, the mental health portfolio sat under the Prime Minister. And 2 years into being a commissioner, it moved to health. I personally think mental health should be under the PM, because it's definitely a multidimensional challenge. It's not just a health problem. It's a housing problem. It's an education problem. There's a cross-section of areas that mental health touches, employment, community engagement, so on. So at the beginning, I was advising the PM and writing recommendations for him, and then that moved to the health minister, who was Greg Hunt by the time the portfolio shifted. And yeah, it was interesting. Like, the other commissioners, there were five other commissioners. Most of them were obviously a lot older than me, had clinical backgrounds. I'd come from building communities. Like, I was the person that a community would call with a massive, very general what I would call a wicked problem, which is a multi-level problem. It's a problem that doesn't just have one root cause. So I was the person that communities would call and say, we've had an increase of suicide by 20% in the past 6 months. Can you help us? And I would go into communities and live in the community and support them towards a solution. And the way that I did that was quite unconventional. It was just me in the beginning, and then eventually I grew a nonprofit that had a team of facilitators who worked in a similar fashion. But the approach was essentially listening. That was the number one principle. So we'd go into the community, we'd have a look at who were the stakeholders of that community. So it might have been the students, the school students, the parents, the teachers, the council members, the safety services, the mental health practitioners, so on. And we would spend a whole day just listening to those stakeholders and holding space. And we would do that over, say, a week or 10 days or sometimes even 2 weeks. And we would take notes and basically would start to see a couple of things. We start to see the discrepancies of where our assumptions were being made that weren't actually true against other members of the community. And we also started to see that fundamentally most of those stakeholders all wanted the same thing, but a lot was getting lost in translation, and there wasn't enough consciousness, there wasn't enough communication skill, there wasn't enough understanding of conflict resolution to actually bridge those gaps. So right at the end of that process, we would bring all of the community members together and basically relay to them what we had heard and give them an opportunity to actually hear each other. And so we were doing reconciliation work or conflict resolution work. I didn't realize that at the time. I was very young. A lot of what I was doing was just intuitive. I now know that that's reconciliation work and community capacity building work. But the long-term impact of that work was really, really significant. Like some communities we were working in that had a 15% attendance at their high school ended up having a 70 or 80% attendance. So that's why the government initially became quite interested in what we were doing, because they were investing literally billions of dollars into these communities, and the problem was getting worse every year. The addiction rate was going up, the mental illness and suicide rate was going up, and we were just young upstarts, you know, like dreamers, literally living in our van, having these really amazing results. And they were like, how are you doing this? We were bootstrapping, you know. The first seed funding I had was a $50,000 sponsorship, and that lasted us over a year traveling rural Australia, you know. So we were really like bootstrapping to the max, but it wasn't about the resource. It was about the approach, and it was the opposite to what a lot of clinicians believed, which is the person who has the mental health challenge doesn't know what's best, and I'm the expert and I need to tell you what to do. We flipped that around and empowered, which I know you're so passionate about, which is why I love what you're doing. We flipped that around and made it an approach of listening, and actually put the person who was suffering in a position where they could become the hero of their own story. And that was, so impactful.
That piece has been fundamental in like the work I've seen too, of what makes a difference and in how I was treated when I was going through the system at different points, you know, when I work with others to help them remember that they have that expertise, that they know what's right, you know, if we can support them to find it. I'm really curious to know, what are some other big foundational pieces that you think are what's rising in this shift?
Around mental health?
Around mental health, yeah, in terms of how we perceive it and how we get better outcomes for people, you know, in particularly the people in distress.
Yeah, I think that the conversation and how that's sort of impacted culture, because there's many ways we can have this conversation. We can have it from a political point of view, and actually this is what I was going to share, is that 4 years that I worked with the commission, there was only just under 97% of the budget was going towards acute crisis intervention when I first became a commissioner. So there was basically no money that was getting put into prevention or early intervention. After 4 years, that shifted the over 20% of the budget being put towards prevention and early intervention. So they're massive shifts. That's a huge shift in budget and focus. That was a recognition on a political level, okay, actually prevention is the way. There is a benefit in influencing culture, and even conversations when I was sitting on the commission around, there was a likening of, okay, well, how did we get people to stop smoking? We ran anti-smoking campaigns, and over time that influenced culture and that had the impact. And I saw that as a really positive thing, not to liken someone who's struggling with a mental health challenge to someone who smokes. But what was powerful about that reframe was the understanding that there are cultural implications that are causing a breakdown in people's mental health. And I thought that was important and powerful. And that's the work that Love Out Loud's doing. It's all cultural. We're influencing culture. So I'm very passionate about movements, social movements, culture, and empowering individuals on the ground to make changes in their lives and show up differently. So I think on a political level, it's changing. On a cultural level, it's also changing. It's gone through waves and shifts. I think initially when there was campaigns that started to emerge, it was amazing that there was awareness that, okay, mental health is a thing, and maybe some of what I'm experiencing and the symptoms I'm experiencing are signs of a mental health challenge. I feel like for a long time the missing piece was something like Are You Okay Day would come around, and there would be an awareness, a huge awareness, and people would be encouraged to ask their friends, are you okay? But still no one was trauma-informed. No one knew actually how to hold each other in those conversations. And I think that that can be quite dangerous as well. And I also think we still have a way to go. And ultimately, like, we can promote learning about trauma and becoming informed on that level. And I think that that's important and powerful, and actually would encourage everyone to learn about trauma, because not many people recognize they have trauma, and they do. But I think there's an even deeper layer there, which is you can learn all the things, but until you know how to be present with your own vulnerability, it won't matter like how much you know. If someone in front of you is in pain and they're struggling, and it's Are You Okay Day, and you ask your friend, are you okay? And they say, actually, I'm fantasizing about suicide, or I've been struggling with depression for years, or I have a drug problem, whatever it is. If you don't know how to feel okay in that vulnerability, your hesitancy and your resistance to that conversation is going to alienate the other person, is going to make them feel polarized, is going to create an unsafe space for them to be vulnerable. And the reason I speak to that is that that's the area of culture that I feel all of us have a responsibility to think about and improve on, not just for each other, but also ourselves. You know, how much greater will our lives be when we know how to be present with those uncomfortable emotions in ourselves, and we're no longer avoiding it or just kind of skimming over it on a superficial level. So I feel like there's more conversation that needs to be had there, and there's more education around how do we do that. You know, like, there's so much distraction in the world. How do we really get okay with sitting with ourselves and holding that space for ourselves, so that we can then be that for those around us?
Like a mental illness or a mental health challenge or whatever experience someone's in, addiction, it's not just about them. Like, we're talking culture, it's so socially laden, but the historical is it's that person's choices, and it really requires us to remember our connectedness, you know, to see the impact of each of us on each other, and that, you know, mental health isn't just about, oh, well, I'm good, so we're good. But it's about how does my choices and my, as you said, whether I'm able to be vulnerable with someone else, how do I receive other people's not okayness? You know, how am I part of this collective story about what it is to be human and what it means to be different and what it means to have setbacks or challenges or to have really shitty days or weeks, years, right? Like, how do we do that? And it's not a me conversation, it's a we.
What comes to mind when I think about the togetherness of this experience was what my journey in working in mental health directly showed me, which is that in a conversation of mental health, getting to the core of that conversation is and should be, and I don't use should very often, a conversation about someone's humanity, you know. And when I started to see that, irrespective of someone's diagnosis or their background or what medication they were on or whatever, was there was a human being and it was a matter of their humanity. The more that I saw that, the more I recognized that this isn't just about mental health as a industry. This isn't just about mental health as a topic even. This is about human beings. And all of us are on a spectrum of good and bad at all times. Like, and maybe that's been the biggest gift, is I don't see someone who's struggling with a mental health challenge in any sort of different light than I see anyone. I just see them experiencing an aspect of the human experience that all of us probably will experience at some point in our life. And I think the togetherness that needs to happen is the recognition that a lot of us have been indoctrinated to think that happiness is king and that that's the final destination. And if you're not happy, then there's something wrong with you. And if you're not grateful all the time, then there's something wrong with you. And the pressure that society's put on us to be in those emotions all the time has created self-judgment and self-criticism. I prefer to see emotions like a practice. We can get really good at practicing how to be in a happier state, or we can become very good at practicing how to be in a not so happy state. But glorifying happiness is putting us in a state of self-rejection. And I think there's a lot of work that we need to do around that. It's not good or bad, better or worse. It's just choice. And in your humanity, when you can be fully held and accepted in your humanity, I think there's a natural empowerment that comes, because I don't know, I'll speak from my experience, in the deepest depths of my challenges and my journey in mental health, what I needed more than anything was to be acknowledged and seen in that pain. It was also the thing that I was shit scared of. So anytime someone got close to seeing that vulnerability, I wanted to run a million miles away from them. But when no one was even close to it, all I craved was for someone to see me. And that's because we all want to be seen and witnessed and acknowledged, and our emotions more than anything just want our acknowledgement. And we want to know we can be loved in that. We can be loved in our mess. We can be loved in states of depression. We can be loved in crippling regret, whatever you're suffering from, and that we can be forgiven, and that we can forgive ourselves. And the more that we normalize that and we talk, I would love to see a shift from the conversation of mental health to emotional awareness and emotional intelligence and presence and what those things mean, because I feel like that is a genuine pathway for people to feel self-empowered through their own mental health journey and story.
Yeah, I think I'm very much on the same page. I think it was when I was in rehab, we went through some modules of training around emotion regulation, and I was like, mindfulness and all these like amazing tools. I was like, why were these not like primary school of like self-awareness, understanding what is going on inside this, you know, human device of, you know, amazingness? That yeah. There's so many experiences that we're not taught a sensitivity or awareness or compassion for ourselves inside that. And mm-hmm. One of my core beliefs is that if we started, you know, that emotional intelligence sort of training in primary school, in 30 years we would have a massive generational shift in terms 100%. Of in the world.
Couldn't agree more with that.
Yeah. Bit of a tangent question. For someone who's been running like a business, and I have a team that I work with, obviously, and there's a lot of companies out there that have gone through a very interesting year. We'll call it the very interesting year. And so one of my questions is, as a leader of other people, like what are your insights from what you do and what you do with Love Out Loud to support the team or business culture with emotional and mental wellness? Because, man, it's been hard.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's a massive question, and it has been a very interesting, crazy year. I'm very grateful that, I guess, the culture in Love Out Loud, the team, as well as the broader community, has really supported our ability to, I guess, consistently reframe what's been thrown at us this year, because the principles of what the movement was founded on are so geared towards being able to do that. You know, one of them is, we're not defined by our circumstances. We're defined by how we respond to it. That's a core principle of how I lead my team. That's a core principle of how the community is. And that's been so foundational in how we've chosen to approach COVID and everything that's unfolded. Similar to you, we were mostly an events-based. Well, our revenue mostly came from events, so we had to really rethink. And I remember getting the call. I'd actually moved to LA last year, and I was running a retreat in Bali. And the only reason I was coming back through Australia was because I couldn't get a direct flight to Bali. So I was in a layover, basically like a 5-day layover, when my assistant called me and she was like, "Have you heard the news?" And I was like, "No." And she said, "They've just closed all the borders." And just like that, a 15-country tour, 5 retreats in amazing countries all around the world, gone, you know. And a new, like, Love Out Loud's on one hand a social movement, on the other hand it's a startup. I had investors I was answerable to. I was looking at, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in refunds. I felt all of that fear, all of it, come through my body like a visceral experience. And yet, thank goodness, because of my practice, I guess, of understanding that we're only ever choosing two things in any moment, love or fear, and it doesn't matter what things look like on the outside, everything comes back to those two choices. And that is a choice. You get to choose the direction that you're going to walk in, which is going to determine your destiny. I recognize that there was fear in my body, in the animal that is my human being. And yet there was a wisdom that was like, Love Out Loud isn't an events company. It's a philosophy of life. And irrespective of what is happening globally, that doesn't take away your responsibility or your ability to keep choosing love and keep choosing what Love Out Loud stands for. So I'm very grateful that I had, I guess, the access to that power to be able to choose love. And I brought my team together, the members that I could. We were trying to get team members from LA to fly in, but it was just getting so complicated. But I was doing my best to get everyone together. And I rented us a really beautiful apartment. And I sat everyone down and I was like, okay, this is how it's going to be. You're either in or out. All good either way, but I'm basically going to comp your life for the next 2 to 3 weeks. I'm not going to pay you any salaries, and we're just going to figure out what this year could look like. And we were exercising actually two principles that we teach in a lot of our immersions. The first is emotional fluency, which is being fluent with your emotions and being able to feel your emotions fully. So having a space where we could actually feel the fear, could feel everything and move into different emotional states. The second principle is emotional agility, so being able to shift quickly and be responsive. And I think that this is a really important part of what leadership needs to look like now and in the future, is responsive leadership, not leadership that's following a model that's been replicated over and over, but leaders who are actually willing to be vulnerable enough to respond to what's happening. And the reason I say vulnerable is because it is vulnerable to respond to to the realities of what's happening. There's no proven concept. There's no, like, you really are leading on the edge. You're pioneering something. And I wholeheartedly believe that my team have done that through COVID. And I'm so proud of them. Every step of the way, we listened. We went against, I feel, what so many other people sort of stepped into, which was a scarcity, which was a how do we save our business? We stepped into how can we radically give? Like, that was our core thing. And what's so, I guess, interesting and such a beautiful confirmation of the philosophy of love is our business not only was not only okay, it actually grew. And we individually called all of those people that were meant to be at our events and explained to them the position we were in. And, you know, 98% of them opted to do one of our courses online, or they stayed with us on the journey. They didn't opt for the refund. And we went on to build different systems and models that actually accommodated the community in a way that was really cooperative. So we really included the community in that journey, in that process, gave them a space that was like a haven away from the anxieties and fears that were kind of around so many of us throughout 2020. And it's been such an adventure. And to be here now, facing, I guess, what's to come with Love Out Loud, it's, we really have utilized so many of what have been the challenges and the setbacks and turned them into opportunities. Like, we're doing a capital raise now to develop an app. We're going to open that up to crowdsourcing as well. And I can see that COVID, I think, like all amazing entrepreneurs, has forced my team and I to really think about how do we be entrepreneurs? How do we turn this adversity into opportunity? It's actually magnified the problem that we're solving in our business, which is fear. Like, Love Out Loud, that is the problem that we're solving. So it really has held a magnifying glass over that problem and given us more of an insight into how we can best serve. So all in all, yeah, it's taught me so many things about leadership. I trust that my team feel exactly the same way, and the community too, because we lent on them. I was very vulnerable through the process. I shared with them the whole way, the fears that were in me and the anxieties. And I called on them a lot to hold me in my leadership as we went through this year too.
That's an incredible reflection, particularly the sharing from the leadership of those vulnerabilities. And it's something I'm imagining a lot of, you know, CEOs or managers or team leaders out there are thinking is such a big jump in terms of their culture to be able to show up and share their fears with their team, with their clients, about the future of their business, about their, you know, needing to close down certain branches or programs or products or actually redirect their services. How do you think a company, gosh, I don't even know where to start with this. Because you know, I think I'm probably a little bit like you. I can see that it'll happen one day. That'll be normal, and that's just how we do things. But it's from this place where we are now. How do we get there?
I mean, this is an ancient message, and I just want to preface with that, because I think any messenger of this message is just standing on the shoulders of giants. And it's surely it's just a matter of time before people listen. Mm. It starts with you. Like, but just really maybe let that land. If you're listening to this, maybe let it land in a different way, because it's become, I guess, what people would call cliche, but it's the truth. So many leaders are not in a place where they've accepted their teams are mirrors of them. So many people are still in blame and separation because they're not whole within themselves. And even the idea of there being a separation between your personal life and your professional life, like, I get it. But if you truly think that integrity ends at 5 p.m. and you can just do whatever you want and you're a leader, you've got to question that, you know, like, the world changes. The world changes when you are in alignment with you. And to me, like, the way I define leadership is demonstration. And to me, demonstration is when you embody it. It's when you make the same choices in alignment to that integrity, even when no one's looking, you know, even when no one could call you out, you're still making those same choices. And I think that's the foundation. When we have leaders that are truly in alignment with their value system, and when they're truly transparent about those value systems and they're not chopping and changing for popularity, I think we see that a lot. You definitely see that a lot in politics, you know, like spruiking a viewpoint just because that's the popular viewpoint. I've even seen politicians do that in mental health. You know, they have no true intention of being that change, but they'll talk about it because it's popular vote. What we need is not necessarily politicians that are like, okay, we'll put another $1 billion into mental health. Not to say that's not good, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. However, I've also seen the mental health budget and how year after year, more and more money was being put into that budget and the problem was rising. So that doesn't create change. What creates change is when a leader steps out into their own vulnerability and says, this is my story, you know, this is my vulnerability, this is how I reconcile my challenges, and they humanize who they are and they break down those barriers. And that's the same on a political level, to actually imagine having political leaders that stay true to their values even when they weren't popular. Like, how great would that be, that we actually knew what we were voting for was true and authentic? And that is definitely, I think, to specifically answer your question about businesses, we need to see more of that in organizational leadership. You can spend so much time as an organizational leader focusing on the back end of your business, which is important and great, but at the end of the day, like, if your team's not functioning, and there's been many studies now to prove this, that when you invest in a team's ability to feel empowered, when you invest in their development, when you invest in their well-being, their performance and therefore the business's growth will be conjunct to how much you're willing to prioritize the well-being of your team. But it takes a lot of effort in leadership, and it takes genuine care, you know, and it's not convenient. It's not always convenient to sit down with your team and have uncomfortable conversations. It's not always going to suit you to step more into your vulnerability and to step out of the mask of being a leader, because leadership's it's a very clever mask. People are not going to question you if you're confident, if you're successful, if you are certain, if you have conviction in the way you speak. I have to very consciously remember that the level of conviction and embodiment I have makes it difficult for a lot of people to challenge me. And the reason I have to remember that is because if I'm wanting to lead and create a culture of togetherness, I have to voluntarily step into my vulnerability. It's a conscious choice that I have to make, and to be with others in that. And that's it. That's the change. If more leaders started to do that, it's not about this is the system, this is the exact steps you have to take. It's that you will be available to truly finding the solutions because you're willing. But whilst you're ticking boxes but not really stepping into the discomfort of what needs to change, nothing will change.
I'm just sitting, absorbing the feelings of all that. Yeah. It's such a shift in the lens to move from the traditional, I suppose, business capitalist approach of, you know, what do we have to get done? How are we getting results? What product or service are we shipping? What's the project time frame? The launch, the budget, what do the investors want? To actually go, you know, at what cost, and to bring in that human cost, as you said, for our team, but also our communities out in the world, like at what cost is, and not just the cost, but the opportunities that arise when we engage deeper, like that we see that's the birthplace place of a whole bunch of new innovations.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not to say, like, just a side note, it's not to say that you need to throw away. Like, I think that there's a healthy balance. And if you just lead with the human first, you'll actually find that the strategy and the figures and all of those things will start to line up more and in a far more sustainable fashion as well. You can have both. You can have emotional awareness and cohesion and connectedness and pragmatism and critical thinking. And, you know, like, a lot of amazing leaders talked about this in their own ways. Steve Jobs was known to be a bit of a taskmaster, but on the other hand, he was all about open sourcing information. Like, he really believed in togetherness. He was a yogi. So, you know, like, a lot of these amazing leaders who have done incredible things actually believe in similar principles. The people that are really playing the long game, you know, that's not always true, but Richard Branson, like, his number one value is relationships. That's how he's built his empire, and he puts people first. And I think there's been huge demonstrations of this in global change makers. I think there's two different races you can run in leadership. There's the instant gratification race and build all the hype and plateau and burn yourself out and have a nervous breakdown before you're 40. Or you can play the long game. You know, you can invest in your people. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And over time, you're going to achieve really amazing things and you're going to build a legacy.
Yeah. It's actually, I almost don't have words, because, like, I'm sort of seeing the futures that kind of, like, keep seeding out of this energy and how it is evolving. I'm so excited to see, you know, the new waves of these innovations that do rise out of the, you know, we've had a lot of opportunity to sit with what's not working and our you know, our, as you said, our distress and anxiety and our fears this year. We've had so much, and from that release, you know, from that self-awareness, there will be new waves of healing and innovation and growth. And
100%. Even just workers being like, I don't have to go and sit at a desk 5 days a week, 9 to 5. Like, that in itself is going to be really interesting, I think, to see. Hopefully the workforce being like, actually, I don't have to do it this way in order to get the job done. It can look different. And I really hope, and if anyone's watching this or listening to this on the LOL podcast or in Sam's Facebook, and you're an employer, don't, you know, be seeking to go back to how things have always been. Like, seize the opportunity. Question how you can utilize what's unfolded in 2020 to create more positive culture. Like, there's massive opportunity in what's unfolded. That's not to dismiss or discredit the pain of what's happened as well. Like, that, of course, there has been huge devastation, but it's our opportunity as leaders to not stay there.
I was wondering if you feel like, if we tangent a little bit to talk about Enlighten, and you share with us a little bit about the sessions that you're going to bring to us and some of those messages. So the first one we've got is a keynote talk you're going to do on empowering yourself to rise out of suffering. Not sure if our title's in evolution, but what's behind this message?
Titles in evolution, love that. It's a work in progress. I really enjoy talking and teaching or sharing about suffering, helping people recognize that pain is something that all humans have to experience. Suffering really is something that we can transcend, and not just individually. I fully believe that we can transcend suffering collectively as well. And so the keynote is going to be an exploration of what that means, what that looks like. I'm going to be talking about identity and how identity attachments and identity constructs prevent us from liberating ourselves from suffering, and how holding on to aspects of ourselves prevent us from being able to let go of suffering. I really want to explore, when we're in pain, the options that we have when we're in a state of pain, and how we can actually retrain ourselves to relate to pain in a different way, which has been a very pivotal part of my personal journey, is understanding that I am not my pain, that I actually have a relationship with my pain. And just like any relationship, I can choose what that relationship is. Once upon a time, I had a relationship. I had a very abusive relationship with pain, and I would use it to punish myself. And now when I'm in pain, I see it as an insight and feedback to what needs my attention. And I allow the pain to actually teach me so that I can progress and evolve myself forward and not stay stuck in that pain, because pain that you stay stuck in will ultimately become suffering. So I'm going to do a deep dive into that.
Sounds so important. I have actually put that one on the first day, because that's one of those foundational pieces of helping yourself really see the power that you have to shift your perspective on how you relate to your life, and as you said, the aspects of identity. Super cool. We also have a workshop from you as well, which is the love-based leadership of self. And do you want to share a little bit on that?
Totally.
Focused on Love Out Loud. And yeah.
I was sharing with Sam that in Love Out Loud as a community, it's a three-phase journey of leadership, that when you come into the community and into the philosophy that is Love Out Loud, you're immediately positioned as a leader, even if you've never seen yourself as a leader. And that leadership journey begins in the first phase of understanding what it means to lead yourself. So claiming your own sovereignty, understanding your own emotions, understanding the way you relate to yourself, how you talk to yourself, how much you love yourself and honestly love yourself. And then through Love Out Loud, you go into, I guess, graduating that and being able to lead others and then go on to lead the world. But for this workshop, we're going to focus on self-love and what that means, but through the lens of seeing yourself as a leader and taking on the responsibility for yourself that a leader has. I think that's very, very pivotal for self-empowerment.
Excited for that one. That will be actually on, where's my list? That one's going to be on day six, which is Thursday. So the conference itself runs from the 24th to the 30th of October. It's going to be 7 days virtual online. We are from 7 a.m. till 10 p.m., which is 15 hours a day. And there's like two streams of content. So it's 30 hours a day, 7 days.
I know, right?
It's nuts. There's physically no way you can actually watch it all, but the tickets are $7 and it includes 2 months of access to all the recordings. So you can actually go and work through and explore and repeat and, you know, just really suck the juice and the goodness and all the gifts out of the actual conference material. And it is, as I said, you know, from my discussions with you and as you can hear from these talks Nicole's crafted for you guys, it's really to help build this new culture, to help individuals that feel stuck or overwhelmed, but also to, from a perspective of leadership, of how do we shift this in a we conversation? How do we support the people around us? How do we show up with more vulnerability and sensitivity to when what we can do to help people that aren't okay.
Yes.
The final thing, the next bit we've got you guys doing is a little daily mini session from the Love Out Loud team, which was Love in Action. So the mini sessions, I think there's about 8 or 10 of them a day, where it's like 5 to 15 minutes where you get a little bite every day of something, a little tasty, snackable, actionable, practical hello.
Super cool.
You going to share what you guys want to do in that, or are you going to keep it a secret and a surprise?
I think we should keep some of it somewhat of a mystery, but what I will say is Love Out Loud as a community are really big on looking at love as an actionable skill set.
Mm.
So we're definitely going to be giving you challenges, things that you can actually action and do that will give you a pathway to experience more love in your life.
Amazing. I'm so excited for that. And that's one thing for me too, like that really fueled my vision of this conference, is that there's so many things talk about let's raise awareness, and yet they're not like, let's give people the stuff to change it. Like, let's give them the tools, let's give them the actions, let's actually shift it while we raise awareness. Like I didn't want to just talk about it.
Sorry. Yeah. So good. So needed.
Yeah. So I will drop a link in the comments below for you guys if you want to check it out. The tickets are as well at awakenhq.com. You'd think I'd remember that part.
Double check, just in case.
Go check that out. We're starting on the 24th. As I said, recordings and that conference group will actually run through till the end of December. So we're giving you guys the rest of the year for that same $7.
Epic. It's
going to be amazing.
So good. So happy to be supporting you, Sam. It's such an incredible vision.
Yeah. Thanks, Nicole. I'm so grateful to have you on board too, because you do bring that beautiful piece of blending the experience inside the policy world, inside the leadership world, and then the lived experience stories and your own perspective as a human. Like you bring a lot of human to the table, is I suppose.
Thank you.
I might say it. Really grateful for this chat tonight.
Likewise. Yeah, thank you.